Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, a quick reminder that this is the last week of KBOO's fall membership drive. We only have a few days left to reach our $55,000 goal. Help us get there by donating today at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. When we think of spectacular landscapes, we usually envision mountain ranges, lush rainforests, or the Oregon coast. But few people recognize the ecological splendor of swamplands, also known as peatlands. While they're just as globally significant as rainforests for their biodiversity and function as a carbon sink, their reputation as wastelands has led to their being systematically drained and degraded. Today we talk with Edward Strzok, whose new book Swamplands explores the unappreciated struggle to save peatlands upon which our planet's survival might depend. Edward, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start by talking about what peat is.
Well, it's partially decomposed vegetation that builds up over time. And for it to become peat, it usually takes about 100 to 200 years, depending where you are in the world. And it just builds up a layer on top of a layer of this partially decomposed material. And once it gets to about a foot, then it becomes peat. So it's what a lot of gardeners know of as a soil conditioner. That's peat.
So that peat moss that my father used to put all around his garden, that was coming from these peatlands?
That's right. They mine it. They continue to mine it for gardening. Canada's the leading exporter of peat, and virtually all of it comes from the wilderness.
So when I was a kid, most of what I learned about peat was that they used it as a heating fuel in Ireland, and I learned from your book many other places. So let's go back in time. Like, when did the relationship between peat and human beings intersect?
Probably, you know, if I was to pick a date, it would be about the year 1000. You know, most of Europe was beginning to be deforested, and trees were a source of energy at the time. So they were looking for new sources of energy. And, you know, by trial and error, they found out that peat actually burns. It's a precursor to coal. So under high temperatures and a high pressure, peat eventually becomes coal. And it burns rather nicely, you know, as the Irish will tell you. And so as more of the trees began to disappear, more and more countries relied on peat. And the Netherlands were really the world leaders in it. They developed an industrial way of draining peatlands, bogs and fens, to dry it out and to turn it into peat briquettes. And so we continued to use it over time. Coal overtook it to some extent, then oil and gas. Whale oil was also in there. But many countries continue to rely on peat. I think Ireland, maybe it's about 6% of the population relies on peat. Estonia, Finland, Sweden, Russia are all still mining peat. And a lot of the African countries now, Burundi and Rwanda, are beginning to drain their bogs and fens systematically to produce peat for power plants. And so they have a long-term plan to essentially have peat as their main source of power.
I want to talk about what bogs and fens are as well. I grew up outside of Boston, and there's a very famous place there called Fenway Park. And when I started hanging out in Boston a little bit more, I discovered that there was an area called the Fen, and I had no idea what it is. So what is a fen, and what distinguishes a fen from a bog?
Well, a fen is largely fed by groundwater, and a bog is fed by precipitation. So that's the main difference. Fens tend to be more acidic than bogs. In fact, they can be really acidic. Some in the Sierra Nevadas, Yellowstone National Park has some of the most acidic fens in the world. In Boston, you have an awful lot of bogs. You know, it's famous for cranberries. I lived in Boston for a while and visited them. But most of those came from original bogs, and then they just basically manipulated it in the way so that they could actually expedite the growth of cranberries from that area.
So do fens and bogs always have like an underlayer of peat that is defining them?
That's they're the two main ecosystems that accumulate peat. Swamps and marshes also do so, but not as much or efficiently as bogs and fens. So bogs and fens are really the best places to grow peat.
Well, when I was a kid, I went to a grade school that was just down the street from a place called Pete's Meadow. And at first, when I was little, I thought it was owned by this guy, Pete. And then I saw how it was spelled. And that's when I started to learn what Pete was. But in your book, you talk about all these other places that are really famous as basically being peat bogs. So I wanted to talk about a few, especially the ones I know well, like Central Park. But let's talk about some of the more famous places that started out being peat bogs and how they were transformed.
Well, you know, Central Park's a great example because, you know, we don't know just how much of it were bogs and how much what might have been fens. But, you know, there was a concerted effort to drain them to create what is now Central Park. And most everyone assumes that it was because we wanted to create parkland, healthy spaces for people. But one of the other reasons was that virtually every medical expert believed that diseases rose out of bogs and fens, more so fens than bogs. And so you got, you know, terms like swamp fever would be an example. People grew up with that. So the whole purpose was to drain them to rid the area of disease. So that's one example. You have others, the San Joaquin Valley, Sacramento in California used to be a huge peatland, but essentially they turned it into agriculture. They churned it up, used it for conditioning the soil, and that's one reason why that part of California is now about 26 feet below sea level, is because when you remove peat, essentially you get this subsidence, because peat is very fluffy. Things grow on top of it, but you remove it, it no longer saturates the moisture. And so over a period of time, that area just got compressed, and that's why they have to have so many dikes along that valley to prevent seawater intrusion. And it's a losing battle.
I wonder if there's any relationship between the peat bogs that were in the Central Valley and further south between Fresno and Bakersfield. There used to be the largest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi called Tulare Lake, which was completely drained. And now they have to irrigate the area. It was turned into agricultural land. Do you know anything about Tulare Lake and if there's a relationship between the peat bogs in the valley and that giant lake?
Well, I do. But here's a correction, is that there are no bogs west of the Rockies. They're all fens. And only one has recently been discovered in Washington. And there's a lot of reasons for that. The main reason is just too dry and warm for bogs to exist. So they rely mainly on groundwater. And you're right, there were an awful lot of these huge lakes, giant bogs, essentially, west of the Rockies and in California, just outside Orange County. There's a great story that I came across in looking through the newspapers, turn of the century, the Los Angeles Times, where they would be harvesting the peat for soil conditioners. And they ended up, this whole crew ended up in the drink. They'd actually got to a certain point and there was this huge, huge underground lake, which was basically a fen, a peatland, that they had exposed. And they could not find the depth of that. And so that fen, along with others, is really what continues to feed a lot of California, Nevada, these really extremely dry places. And of course, well, as we all know, that they're beginning to dry up and we're going to have to find some other way of quenching the thirst of that part of the world, because those have become so badly degraded that they're not going to come back.
Well, it's also interesting to see how many different kinds of geographic locations are famous for having fens and bogs. And I guess we don't really think about high altitude fens, though I was introduced to one in the Siskiyou Mountains in Southern Oregon that was adjacent to an area that was logged right after the Biscuit Fire in 2002. And that was actually my introduction to seeing fens outside of Fenway Park, to see what a fen really looked like. So I wanted to talk about the variety of places where fens exist. And did you find some that really surprised you?
Yeah, you know, just to start off, about 80% of the fens are located in cold climate areas, in the boreal forest, temperate forest of Canada, Minnesota, Alaska, Russia, Scandinavian countries. They're really a relic of the last ice age because, you know, fens are created by a form of swamping. And so when the glaciers receded very rapidly, you'd get this swamping. It would kill whatever trees were in the path, and the only thing that really rose up after that were a lot of mosses such as sphagnum, and they built over time. It was really too cold for deciduous trees to take root. And I always assumed that that was basically it, and most scientists did as well, but then, you know, there was David Cooper from Colorado State started doing, you know, surveys of the high elevations in the Rockies, in Colorado, for example, and was finding fens at 10,000 feet, and also many of them containing relics, plants from the last ice age, plants that you don't find anywhere else in the state of Colorado or Nevada. And as they were doing more and more inventories, I think, you know, the numbers is now in the thousands that they have found. They also used to didn't think that bogs and fens could actually be in the tropics because it was just too hot. But in 2017, they found the world's largest tropical bog in Africa and in the Congo, Republic of Congo. And of course, now we're beginning to find enormous peatlands in Indonesia. And it's largely because there was this bias in the scientific community is that heat could not produce bogs or fens, but really what really is the key is swamping, you know, really, really wet conditions.
Are there any bogs or fens in deserts?
Yes, there is. In the Mojave Desert, there is one, and it's a relic. It has been worked over so many times that basically it's on its last legs, and the only thing that's keeping it going is that there's this 15,000-year-old fossil water that continues to come out of the mountains through a subterranean river system that trickles water in, quite a bit of water still. But that's one of the most unusual, and I think one of the most fascinating. But there are other little places. There's some in Australia. Mexico has them, so they're still around. They're hanging in there, and it's largely they're relics of another age, and they're being fed by fossil water.
Well, it seems that peatlands, swamplands, have been much maligned over the centuries, and it's contributed to the degradation of a lot of peatlands. Why is it that people fear peatlands or despise them?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's many reasons. One is that, you know, you get these swamp gases, methane, that actually can light up at nighttime. So, you know, in Ireland and Scotland, they call them corpse candles, will-o-wisps, and they attach stories to these lights that they saw. And it was always a sinister story, and they were passed down from one generation to another. And I think that's one of the classic examples. The other one is that I talked about earlier is that they really did believe that many of these peatlands were actually sources of disease, that if you lived anywhere near a bog or a fen, you would come down with swamp fever, for example. And in the 1850s, right up until the 1920s, many doctors refused to believe that it was either a virus or bacteria that caused the disease. It was some miasma, as they call it, rising up from these wet, awful places. And so we've demonized them. We've demonized in literature, you know, Shakespeare, Mary Shelley, a long list of British authors have use peatlands as a source of haunts of evil spirits and miserable places, and we here in America inherited that with the settlers that came over. They brought over those biases, And there was William French, who was the Treasury Assistant Treasury Secretary of the United States, who was bent on draining every bog and fen and swamp and marsh in the United States. Quoting a Scottishman that he admired so much, he said that the whole earth should be drained.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Edward Strutzik, whose new book, Swamplands, explores the unappreciated struggle to save peatlands upon which our planet's survival might depend. What happens when you start to take away the peat, when you either are draining it for agricultural lands or using it for either fertilizer or for heating fuel? Why is it that peat really should be in the ground?
Well, one of the big reasons that, you know, that's pertinent to what's going on right now is that it stores an awful lot of carbon. So it represents only 3% of the Earth's landscape, but it holds more carbon, twice as much carbon as all of the world's forests combined. So that's one reason to leave it in the ground, because it's really an insurance policy against further warming. The other reason is that subsidence. You know, a lot of coastal areas in the United States are coated in peat, and peat, sphagnum, for example, can hold 16 to 25% of its moisture. So this can actually help us deal with seawater rises and, you know, storm intrusions, saltwater intrusions. And it's really hard to kill a moss sphagnum. They are just a super plant. I know one scientist who found one in a glacier in the high Arctic that was 500 years old, melted it out, and she took it back to her lab and it grew. So, you know, they're extremely resilient, unlike trees, you know, which are very subject to disease, to drought. And they also, you know, are a firefighter's best friend. If you think about it, a wetland will stop a fire in its track. Every firefighter knows this. And there was a classic example. You've been up to the oil sands in Fort McMurray. They evacuated 88,000 people out of there in 2016 when the fire tore through there. And what really fooled the firefighters at the time was that they thought that this fin that was located south of Fort McMurray would actually stop or slow the fire long enough for them to get on top of it. But when the fire got to that fin, it just raced through. And it was only after that they discovered that it was actually purposely drained to grow trees on top of it. And so those trees ended up being black spruces, which are one of the most flammable trees you will find in the boreal forest. So instead of slowing things down, it raced through. Had the fin been there, maybe 88,000 people wouldn't have had to be evacuated. Maybe wouldn't have had $9 billion bill to deal with those fires. And California is facing the same problem because they've drained most of their wetlands, their peatlands. And right now I know that they are working on a number of projects to restore those areas for firefighting purposes.
Talking about the way that peat has been much maligned, I think it really is represented in the name of this, the first swampland that you talk about in the book called the Great Dismal Swamp. I wonder who came up with that name. Let's talk a little bit about what that swamp is and the roles that it's played throughout history.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating place. It's a huge swamp located on the Virginia-North Carolina border, and it was encountered by the Jamestown settlers in 1604, 1608, I can't remember which year. And there was a plan put in place. You know, the first thing that they grew was tobacco. And they ran out of land to grow tobacco. And there was an American named William Byrd who got the idea of draining the Great Dismal Swamp to turn it into a big tobacco, rice, and corn farm. And no one listened to them, largely because they were dealing with North American indigenous people who lived there that didn't like this idea of them destroying the ecosystem, burning it up, trying to drain it. And it wasn't until George Washington came along and he created a company, the Great Dismal Swamp, Adventures of the Great Dismal Swamp, which was a company that he formed to drain that swamp. And it was in existence for about 30, 40 years. Congress invested in it. And for over a period of 100 years, there were many efforts to drain the swamp, to turn it into agricultural land, and also, more importantly, later on, to get all of the white cedars, Atlantic white cedars, that grew prolifically in that area. And so what we have now is a remnant. It's still huge. It's still a really big swamp, but nothing like what we had when the Jamestown colonists first came. And in fact, basically everything from Maine down to Georgia was swampland, peatland. Everybody, every settler, their first order of business was to drain all these fens and bogs and marshes along the way, because they saw it as an impediment to agriculture, a threat to their health. And so they systematically drained all of these fens.
You mentioned that indigenous people were living in the Great Dismal Swamp. Why was it that they could be living there, but white settlers found that it was, well, I guess the white settlers actually named it the Great Dismal Swamp. Is that correct?
Yeah, it wouldn't have been called the Great Dismal by the indigenous people. The indigenous people, you know, found places to live, like in the Pocosins, which is just adjacent to the Great Dismal Swamp. In higher elevations, where you would not have as much water infiltrating the ecosystem. But what they did more frequently was go in there to hunt. You know, you have the Great Dismal has more black bears per square mile than any place outside of Minnesota, and deer abound there. They have an incredible amount of wildlife there. And so they fed themselves there. And they also knew how to harvest plants for pharmaceutical purposes. I think there are like 576 plants in the United States that we know of that grow in fens and bogs that are used for pharmaceutical purposes by indigenous people. And some of the root vegetables that they found they would eat there. And interestingly enough is that the enslaved people, when they escaped from the plantations, when they couldn't have enough, had enough with the abuse, ended up taking refuge in places like the Great Dismal and very quickly adapted like the indigenous people did. And there are many wonderful stories about them describing, you know, how wonderful the water was in certain places. The fish were everywhere. You know, there was more venison than you could ever hope for. So compared to life on a plantation, you know, this was a form of paradise. And many of them ended up, you know, on the Underground Railroad and found freedom in northern environments. But quite a few families ended up staying, you know, 2, 3, 4 generations, because they had actually made a, you know, fairly comfortable living there.
Well, why is it that they were able to do that and so were indigenous people, but white people just were completely put off by it and only saw it as a place of disease that needed to be drained?
Well, I think, you know, it's inhospitable. If you go to the Great Dismal Swamp, one of the things that they'll show you is a video, and they'll tell you that bug spray is not enough. That this will not prevent you from being tortured by bugs, and so you have to dress properly. I think that was one, the fact that you know, Europeans came with the prejudices against these places. They saw them as sort. William Byrd did. He saw it as a source of miasma, and that was one of the secondary purpose for draining it, is to get rid of the disease that lurked there. So they saw it as a completely different kind of ecosystem, whereas indigenous people and enslaved people went in there and looked at it and thought, whoa, there's really, you know, a pretty nice assortment of, you know, of foods that we can use, and wonderful fresh water. We just came with all of our European biases and prejudices, and we attached them to the landscape here, and we didn't learn. And of course, we saw indigenous people as primitive, enslaved people as primitive. So we learned very little from them earlier on.
Were there any other fens or bogs that served as refuges for marginalized people?
Yeah, pretty much, you know, everywhere you go. In the Mojave Desert, there was a lot of outlaws ended up taking refuge in the Fen in the Mojave and making not a great living, but it was a place where the law would not catch up with them, because who wants to go on a horse in 105 degree temperatures and not knowing exactly where they were, but and not understanding the country? But many of them set themselves up by these, you know, these pools of water percolating up. They grew their own food, and they became legends in their own right. There's been, you know, some local histories talk about all of these outlaws who kind of became good guys, you know, the bad guy, good guy character in American literature.
Let's talk about the diversity of plant and animal life there, because that's something else that I think people don't recognize when they look at swamplands. They think of, I think when most people think about biodiversity, they think of tropical rainforests. So how does a bog or a fen compare with a tropical rainforest in terms of the wide range of life that it supports?
Well, you know, a boreal or a temperate bog or the Great Dismal Swamp simply does not have the biological diversity that, you know, the Amazon rainforest has. But what they do have is that, you know, think of it, there's 3 billion birds from the United States that fly north into the boreal fens of Canada for a reproductive purpose that sends 4 to 5 billion birds back to the United States. So they're, you know, they're incredible nesting grounds. But and they're also places where a lot of the critically endangered species in both Canada and the United States have found a refuge. You know, the red wolf, which was declared extinct in the United States in 1977, has been reintroduced to the Pocosans fenlands with some success, a lot of controversy, and also the Great Dismal Swamp. The cockaded woodpecker, you know, which was following in the footsteps of the ivory-billed woodpecker, is also being reintroduced into these fenlands. Caribou, which are critically endangered all through North America, basically spend 50-60% of their time in fens and bogs because, you know, they eat lichen, and lichen grows in fens and bogs. They also escape from fires, wildfires, because these places are wet. And also, it's a way to get away from predators because, you know, wolves tend not to like to be sloshing around in a bog or a fen chasing a caribou. They would rather do it on hard, open, hard ground. So there's a whole number of purposes, but we're also beginning to find new species and existing species that are doing things in fens that we never thought that they would do. So I was out with an entomologist who was looking for a moth, and only 8 had ever been found in North America. And everybody thought they were a critter of sand dunes. And so this entomologist was looking, you know, spent a good part of his early life looking for them. And one was accidentally caught in a fen. And he had this eureka moment. He said, maybe if I started looking in fens, I might find more. And so he spent 118 days traveling 3,000 miles sloshing through fens in the Michigan area, Wisconsin, and Western Canada, and he found 56. And he continues to look and add to the numbers because they now realize this moth that everybody thought was extinct is actually not a sand dune dweller. It does pretty well in these fens. And so we're discovering something new almost every year about fens and their role in nurturing wildlife.
What do you think is the quality of fens that has this ability?
A number of things. You know, the water tends to be very acidic, so there are certain plants, like as we know, the monarch butterfly is attached to the milkweed. And that pretty much, you know, goes with, you know, with many butterflies and moss. They tend to be attached to a particular plant. And so fens have these plants that are acidic, and they're attracted to them. They could not find them outside of a fen. And also, these plants are unique in that they've evolved in a way that in an ecosystem where pathogens and predators can't come because they don't like acid. And so you have this kind of unique world of, you know, acid-loving critters playing off of each other, along with fungi, you know, which facilitate communication between different trees and roots. It's just a whole world that we're only beginning to understand. One of my favorite is that just in 2018, 3 years ago, a scientist accidentally found a pitcher plant, which is a classic peatland plant. It's carnivorous. Everybody knows that it eats insects. But what he found was that they actually eat juvenile salamanders as well. He found these salamanders inside, and the more he looked, the more found that, yeah, that's part of their food chain. And I find that just so cool.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Edward Sturzig, whose new book, Swamplands, explores the unappreciated struggle to save peatlands upon which our planet's survival might depend. I want to remind you that this is the last week of KBOO's fall membership drive. Help us reach our $55,000 goal by donating today at kboo.fm/give. Or you can also text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. One of the things about peat that's interesting to me is we discover its importance and its existence often through disasters. And I'm thinking about all the peat land that was burned in Indonesia as a result of the palm oil plantations. So I want to talk about what that meant. First of all, why it was burned and what the impacts of those fires were.
Well, it was burned to create, as you said, palm plantations, which is a valuable resource used all throughout the world. And the Indonesians realized that this was a moneymaker, and it was a lot easier to drain their peatlands, which are vast, and grow these very fast-growing trees. But the problem is that once peat dries, it becomes very flammable. You know, it's the precursor to coal. And so lightning or machinery, sparks from machinery, can light it up. It doesn't really flame. It tends to smolder. And it's very difficult to put out because it burns below the ground. It can burn up to 3 feet below the ground. And I'll give you an example of how hard it is to put out a peat fire. There was one in the Pocosins, sometime in the 1990s, maybe the 2000s. No, it was the Great Dismal Swamp. There were both in both places, but in the Great Dismal Swamp, it burned so far below ground that no amount of water that they were diverting into the swamp where that was burning could put out the peat fire. And then Hurricane Isabella came along. So I think this is 2011 or 2013. And they thought, the hurricane is going to put it out. But the hurricane didn't produce enough moisture to actually put it up. It took 2 or 3 more tropical storms to get that thing under control. And that's what Indonesia is facing, is that they have got these peat fires that smolder for months and sometimes years. And the more they harvest or they drain their peatlands, the more vulnerable they become to fire. And they're also releasing incredible amounts of carbon and air pollution. Air pollution in Indonesia in the last 10 or 15 years has been off the charts. And there have been, you know, hospitalizations from people with respiratory problems, all that go back to this idea that, you know, we can turn these peatlands into palm plantations. It's really one of the, you know, great, awful ecological disasters of our generation.
Well, I want to go on to an even worse ecological disaster. We were talking a little while ago about the fire in Fort McMurray a few years ago. But one of the things that I guess a lot of people don't know about the tar sands that start just up north of Fort McMurray, actually south of it a bit too, is that the tar sand pits are all on what was incredible peatland. So what's happened to the peat in the tar sands area of Alberta?
Well, most of it's gone because of laws that have been put in place, thanks to a lot of celebrities, Neil Young, James Cameron. People in the United States have stepped up and said, you know, you can't get away with this. They've made an effort to try to restore these peatlands, but it's a very difficult process because, you know, if you look at what the tar sands does, is that they tear off the top layer of peat, and they put it aside, and then they dig up to 200, 300 feet down to get into the bitumen. And along the way, they drain all of the water, the fan, you know, the underground streams that fed those wetlands and diverted them, dammed them up. So they've been, you know, I don't even think there's a 1 square mile of peatland that has been stored in the oil sands, and yet they continue to, you know, mine it every year. The only good thing that's coming out of it is that the Canadian government, along with the oil sands, has been trying to figure a way of growing peat there. They're spending an awful lot of money. I doubt that it's going to be successful in the oil sands, because I don't think the oil sands really cares. You know, they're just trying to show the public they're doing something, the social license on their part. But another, it may be useful for other less degraded ecosystems around the globe. And so right now you're seeing Russia is rewetting their peatlands. China has restored the Zogi Plateau, which is the largest mountain peatland in the world. They drained it during the Cultural Revolution and realized what an ecological disaster that was. So we're starting to find this expertise coming into play. The Russians are doing it to try to stop wildfires. They've realized they've hit the wall, and they're doing it with the help of Germany, which is offering financial support and expertise, because they become experts in growing peat. And Germany's not just doing it for climate change purposes, they're also doing it for diplomatic purposes. To keep the door open, talking to Putin, here's what we can do for you. And so peat has become a form of diplomacy, I'd like to say. And this is one of the beauties of peat, is that, you know, you look at the decline of sea ice and glacier and the meltdown of glaciers. There's really nothing that we can do in the next 100 to 200 years that's going to be able to reverse that. But we can actually grow or accumulate peat is a better word for it, but I like to say grow. We can actually do it fairly economically. And the peat moss harvesters, the industry, has been doing this since Johnson & Johnson started doing it in the late 1990s. They created a peat moss-based sanitary napkin for women that they sold in 85 countries as kind of an environmentally friendly product. And they were harvesting the peat from a bog in Quebec, about 7 times the size of Central Park. And somebody in the company late in the 1990s had this moment where they realized that, you know, wetlands are becoming incredibly popular now. They're the new, you know, thing out there. And this may be turned on us. We're draining this huge, huge peatland, this bog in Quebec. And so they stopped. They actually stopped producing the product, and they hired a team of scientists to restore it. They didn't do it, you know, entirely successfully, but they learned enough that the science of growing peat now is becoming much more sophisticated.
Are there places around the world, though, where they're still harvesting peat for fuel or for other matters, for agricultural matters?
Yep. It's, in Ireland, Estonia, the Scandinavian countries, African countries, they're all doing it. Great Britain has vowed to ban the use of peat by 2024 because their peatlands have been so badly degraded. Canada, as I said earlier, is the biggest exporter of peat. And where does it all go to? Pretty much to Americans south of the border. So there's a movement afoot to, you know, try to curtail this worldwide effort, because the people now, scientists now and policymakers now, are beginning to recognize how important it is to mitigating floods, slowing or stopping wildfires, storing carbon. It's becoming a very valuable commodity. And I think that it's just a matter of time before it becomes a big thing here in North America. It is in places like Europe and beginning to become like that in Russia and China. But that has not come to North America just yet.
Well, it seems to me that people in North America are still pretty ignorant about peat, even though most of us live on what were former peatlands. And I wonder how the necessity of keeping peat in the ground can be connected to the necessity of keeping oil, coal, and gas in the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great analogy. The problem in in North America was summed up very nicely by Joni Mitchell. Is you don't know what you lost until it's gone, and that's why Europeans and Scandinavians and the Irish are so in tune with it, because they've destroyed most of it and now they're paying the consequences. You know, subsidence, ecosystem failures, right across Europe, because peatlands have been destroyed. I think that what we've got to do in North America is try to understand, come to grips with the fact we're heading in the same direction. The beauty of it here in North America, especially in places like Minnesota, the boreal forest, temperate forests of Canada and Alaska, is that most of our peatlands are still relatively pristine. And many in the United States that have been degraded can be restored fairly economically and efficiently. So we can do something. I use the analogy, Jane Goodall is going around saying we should, everybody should plant trees, which is great. I'm not arguing that point. But my point is that I think you're going to get a bigger bang for the buck by restoring a peatland than you are growing trees. I'm not saying you shouldn't grow them, but it's cheaper to do. It has more value. They're almost indestructible, unlike trees, which burn very readily, very quickly. So you could grow a heck of a lot of trees, and a wildfire can basically undo 20, 30 years of effort. That is not likely to happen in a peatland. So my argument is that if we protect what we have left and try to restore what is restorable, we will go a long way to making this planet a healthier place.
Well, I have concerns about what's going on in the tar sands because of the destruction of so much of the peatland there. And I wonder if there's a possibility of actually having the force to make the fossil fuel industry up there become accountable for what they're destroying.
Well, good luck. I've been following this for 34 years, and it's come to the point where it's just too big to fail. And so you have politicians on both sides of the border that understand that, this is this fossil fuel is this way of generating energy is dying. But there's so much money invested in it, so many people working in those areas, that to be able to, ramp it down quickly is in the short term is unlikely. I think what's going to happen in the medium to long term is that it's just going to self-destruct. It's just going to be too expensive to continue doing what they're doing. And they will just decide at some point, we're getting out of this and we're shifting, as many of them doing. Suncor, one of the biggest oil sands companies, now has one of the biggest wind farms in Canada.
Well, that's good news.
they're beginning to move their assets in other directions. But you've seen it. It's so big. It's just so, and I have my friends, many colleagues say, we should just shut it down. And I'm a realist that it's just too much money invested. There are just too many jobs to be able to do that expeditiously.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Edward Strutzig, whose new book, Swamplands, explores the unappreciated struggle to save peatlands upon which our planet's survival might depend. Well, let's get now to the planet in peril part of this interview. I want to talk about the connection between peat and permafrost.
Well, permafrost is, frozen, in many cases, most cases, it's frozen peat. And it occurs, all through Alaska, most of northern Canada, parts of Scandinavia, and northern Russia. The area is vast. And the amount of peat and carbon that is stored in permafrost is enormous. What we're seeing now, because of climate change, and also human disturbances such as the oil sands, is we're beginning to see it thaw out. And as it thaws out, it's releasing that carbon. And I think this is one of the very, great vexing problems, is that how do you slow it down? We know that we can't slow down the meltdown of glaciers or sea ice, And I think this is analogous to that situation. You know, there's a Harvard-led effort to shoot these, you know, silica-like particles into the air to try to reflect the sunlight back. But indigenous people in Scandinavia have stopped that. So I don't know what the answer is, but it certainly is one of the more scary developments that's taking place in the peatlands around the world. The beauty of it, though, is most of the richest areas of carbon, the carbon is stored up, you know, as deep as 100 feet below. And so in order for climate change to get that far down is going to give us several hundred years of time to work with that. It's what's happening in the upper layers right now that's a little bit of a concern, or a little bit of a concern, it's a major concern. So a lot of peat is being blown off. The other problem associated with it is that you think about frozen peatlands on the tundra is that it's a combination of, it's really a frozen bog. So it's up to 70 to 90% moisture. So when it thaws out, it just turns into a big pool of water. And so we're essentially creating flooded areas that are destroying forests in the northern part of the boreal forest because peatlands are thawing out. So we're having all kinds of, you know, crazy dynamics taking place. No one knows exactly which direction it's heading to, but it's a scary situation.
Well, I want to talk about an ally that you mention in your book, which is the beaver, and how that helping beaver return to some of their habitat might actually maybe mitigate some of these issues.
Well, we know the beavers are masters at building dams. You know, they're nature's plumber. And a classic example is that there's a mountain fen called the Sibbald Fen in the Canadian Rockies, which is managed by beavers. And the beauty of their management is that they've hold back water in times of flood, and they release water in times of drought. And so they become wonderful managers. They always have been. The problem is we've trapped them out in most of the United States and quite, you know, most of parts of southern Canada. There have been frequent efforts. In the 1940s and 1950s, in areas like Wisconsin, they were actually flying and parachuting beavers out of areas where they were creating floods into areas where they might start floods so that they create pools of water for firefighters. Great Britain now, England has brought in, and Scotland has brought in beavers. They were, I think, extinct for about 200 years to help restore wetlands. And I think the latest study I saw on one was that the beavers have done in 10 years what people, engineers, couldn't do in 50 years. So, you know, they're a great ally, and they're prolific at reproducing. The only potential problem is that if they get out of control, we have, you know, maybe flooding in places where we don't want flooding. But really right now, flooding in most of North America is not a big issue, especially, you know, where there are peatlands.
Actually, I think that they could use some beavers in California.
They're actually experimenting with it. When I spoke at the governor's wildfire summit in 2018 or 19, a number of them came back to me and said, "Yeah, they're actually reintroducing beavers as experiments in the way of recreating wetlands and helping to manage fires and holding back water in times of drought."
Well, I know that several of the tribes in Oregon, both in southern Oregon, the Klamath tribes and other tribes in the north, and also in Washington State, have been reintroducing beaver and really working to help, to allow the beaver to be protected so that they can do their job, which is to be nature's engineers. However, in Oregon, it's still legal to trap beaver for all kinds of bogus reasons. And there was an effort to have some legislation passed this past session that would have banned certain trapping of beavers on federal land. and it didn't ever get anywhere. So it seems like, again, like understanding the importance of peatlands, that we don't quite appreciate the importance of beaver. And what do you think we need to do to overcome that obstacle?
Well, maybe, you know, lead by example. The U.S. government traps more beavers than I think anybody else because they see it as a nuisance animal. You know, without any proof, without any environmental impact statement, they've just been doing it for so long without anybody challenging. And it goes back to the days where they were exterminating wolves. It wasn't until scientists started challenging, you know, that philosophy, that strategy, that they stopped doing it and now reintroducing them. I think this is what we need, is more voices for the beaver. And the beaver tends not to be as, say, charismatic as the wolf is in certain segments of the population. But that can easily be corrected. I think, you know, it's just got to be pointed out that the U.S. government is destroying beaver populations that could serve an ecological purpose. And someone needs to challenge them. If it was, you know, the Department of the Environment, you might have some success. But because it's the Department of Agriculture, you know, it becomes another kind of story. It's not an environmental story anymore. It's about farmers. So it's all so convoluted. I think there is a way, but we need an organization to, you know, champion the beaver at some point down the road.
Well, one of the worst horror stories you tell in your book is plans that they had, I guess, back in the 50s to detonate nuclear bombs in northern Alberta to release enough heat to melt the bitumen so that it could be mined successfully for tar sands. I want you to just tell that story briefly and maybe look back at, have we made some progress since those days?
Well, we've made progress since then, because there really was Atlantic Richfield, which was based in California at the time, came up with this plan to explode a nuclear device that would create a hole and heat big enough that it would melt out the oil from the bitumen and create just this big reservoir of oil, and it could be shipped out from that. And it was in play for a good 10, 20 years. I think the U.S. government gave it the go-ahead. The Canadian government seriously considered it. But I think what happened is that it just died because it became, you know, wholly impractical. Would it really work? But, you know, they also had this plan to drop atomic bombs on the peatlands and the Hudson Bay lowlands, which are the largest peatlands outside of Russia and the most pristine peatlands in the world. This is where you have 1,200 polar bears. And the idea really was that, you know, they were planning to, you know, this was a nuclear atom bomb testing area. And the only reason that it didn't go ahead was the British, who were behind the plan, thought it would be too cold. So they ended up exploding the bombs on some Australian islands. And to this day, you know, what, 70 years later, you can only visit that island for a period of a couple of hours because of the radiation that's there. Have we come, you know, anywhere since then? Obviously we have. But, you know, we found other ways of destroying the environment, you know, as the oil sands companies have. We tend to do it more strategically, more incrementally. You know, they have a public relations team that, you know, would put some government departments to shame in their ability to spin these issues. And so I think we really still have this enormous challenge ahead of us to somehow grapple with this idea that fossil fuels is not the future, you know, that we really need to go alternative fuels. We need to rely more on solar. The fact that Rwanda and Burundi have a long-term plan to, you know, power most of their countries on peat rather than solar and wind just boggles the mind. Why are they doing it? Because it's easily exploited. And the World Bank, for example, isn't giving them money to do it. So we really need to have a different, you know, a real shakeup in the way we see the world, I think.
Well, I hope your book helps to do that. Was that part of your intention in writing it?
Yeah, I thought that, you know, here's just this tiny footprint on our planet. 3% of the world's earth is our peatlands, and they pack such a big, you know, punch on so many different levels, and yet they've been ignored, you know, to our benefit to some extent, because, you know, we've kind of left them alone, and so many of them still remain pristine. this is an answer to a climate change problem that we have. You know, it's not going to solve the problem, but it's one way of moving forward, I think, in a very significant way.
Well, Edward, thanks so much for being on Locus Focus. It's great to talk to you.
It was great to talk to you as well.
We've been talking with Edward Strutzig, author of Swamplands, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us reach our $55,000 goal now, during this final week of our pledge drive, by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Lauren Goldberg with Columbia Riverkeeper about the latest horrors planned for the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. We're going to go out with some music by Duke Ellington. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.